Like, there's a lot of meaning. There's a lot of
Yeah.
meaning in what we do, Alex.
Aww. There is.
You're not going to talk to me for like 5 days after
No. I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And
And I'm
I'm
a
a
writer.
writer, but. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Deborah Shapiro. Deborah Shapiro is the author of the novels The Sun in Your Eyes, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, The Summer Demands, and Consolation. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Review of Books, Sight Unseen, Chicago Magazine, Literary Hub, Washington Square Review, and elsewhere. She lives with her husband and son in Chicago. Welcome, Deb.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
Same.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I could not put your book down. I loved it so much. And I
That means
can't
a
wait to
lot
talk.
to hear.
Oh man, it's so wonderful. And almost indescribable, but we'll get to that.
Trying.
Before we get to that, we would love to hear you read from it.
Great. So I'm gonna read just the opening few pages. And it's about what happens when this young celebrated photojournalist is killed in a car accident, and these three women whose lives overlap with his are kind of left to reckon with that loss, and the ways that their lives intersect in the wake of his death. And so this first chapter is from the perspective of a woman named Justine. "I shouldn't be here," she thought. "A space filled with light, but not gleaming, an autumnal mood, even in summer. On the white walls hung paintings and photographs, some of which she recognized, and a stretch of windows gave out onto rooftops and water towers, a span of the Manhattan Bridge. It was one of those downtown lofts made habitable 40 years ago and not updated much since. You might go by on the sidewalk below and never know all that existed above you. I shouldn't be here." But here she was, just as the guests were starting to assemble and take seats. All she had to do, now that it was too late to leave, was find an empty spot, preferably in one of the rows near the back. The crowd was mostly of an indeterminate age, somewhere over 30 and under 50, like her, though there was an older element too, and it was their presence, Justine felt, that solidified her sense of having entered an exclusive world that operated with an indifference to her own. Wine or water? The question came from a gaunt woman whose angular glasses, black caftan, and coarse red hair gave her an oracular look, and whose sudden appearance at Justine's side contributed to the effect. Drinks to make the atmosphere more celebratory than somber. It would be that kind of memorial service. Though Justine said, "Water, please," and the woman gave her water before moving along, she sat in the nearest chair and cupped the glass as if it were a potent elixir. Like Alice coming upon the little bottle with the label around its neck, "Drink me." Up front, a tall and slightly stooped man stood to speak, and the murmuring crowd went quiet. "Hello, people." He introduced himself as Alex Greenman and welcomed them all to his home. Alex Greenman. Not too long ago, Justine had gone with her husband to a retrospective of Alex Greenman's early street photography, his mid-career portraiture, and his later landscapes. She'd seen portraits of the man himself, clearly taken some time back, when his eyes weren't quite so pouchy, the folds around his mouth not nearly as deep. Hands in pockets, he'd accrued a shuffling appeal, a schlumpiness that could only be mistaken for modesty by someone very innocent, who wouldn't recognize it as earned, as the outward expression of an understated power. Alex Greenman, the famous photographer. Down the rabbit hole I've gone. She took a sip. "We all knew and loved James Driscoll." "Yes, I knew him. I must have loved him too, in a way." "What a loss. What a loss." Greenman swallowed. "I'm not much of a speaker." He paused, shook his head, and Justine couldn't help but think that this hesitation, genuine as it might have been, had the effect of suggesting that what he lacked in rhetorical skill, he made up for in another realm, his visual acuity. but I wanted to thank you all for coming and say a few words. Many of you know my wife, Susan. He nodded to the woman with the wild red hair, now sitting up close. I don't know that we thought of James as a son, and I don't want to presume to know how he felt about us, but we certainly were devoted to him, right, Holly? He nodded to yet another woman, one Justine couldn't completely make out through the rows of mourners. Holly, James's aunt, is a very dear friend of mine. She brokered the deal, you could say, between me and James when he grew up and came to New York. You know, I thought as a favor to Holly, I'll meet with this kid and give him some avuncular advice, introduce him to a few people, that'll be that. Soft, rueful laughter from those seated, a collective release. But that wasn't that. Greenman spoke of James's talent and drive, how it made him feel, in comparison, like a privileged dilettante, but also made him excited, again, about photography itself. That James would have gone on to do such vital work, though what he'd already accomplished was important and lasting. I hope he knew that. I think he did. He was more than his work, though, so I want this to be an opportunity for anyone, for everyone here to say something if they'd like. To share, to remember the time you spent with him, to make a toast if you wish, okay? He raised his hands, ducked his head of gray yet still thick hair. Okay, okay, a growing energy in the room, arising to Greenman's request as he opened the floor. A hint of raucousness of what this could become, given the large personalities in attendance. Justine listened as a parade of those personalities, other photographers, editors, activists, news people, art people, offered their recollections and condolences to each other. A rumpled man with lizard eyes spoke of being on assignments with James in Ukraine, in Tunisia, in New Orleans, and how James had a habit, wherever they were, of seeking out the local dessert, as if partaking of a culture's minor indulgences would yield a protective effect. The director of an environmental justice organization recalled in croaky tones, James at an awards ceremony, "You'd never have guessed," she said, "how much this low-key, in-the-streets guy liked himself in a well-cut suit. He didn't particularly want the award, but he kept the suit." Did any of this square with the person Justine had known, however briefly, however indefinably? Did it need to? She wasn't sure. She wasn't even sure what had drawn her here, only that it had seemed compulsory when she'd discovered the details for the memorial service online. She and James had shared one winter weekend long ago in New England when they were kids, and then they'd been here on these Lower East Side streets in their early 20s, almost younger than when they were children, more unknowing, though maybe it only felt like that in retrospect. He'd gone ahead and made a name for himself. She'd seen it in publications over the years, made note of it each time, occasionally acknowledged a certain pride in his accomplishments and a gauzy disappointment in herself. But she hadn't registered just how much of a name he'd made, really, until now, here in Alex Greenman's loft. She had made something else for herself, a life, you might argue, but hardly a name.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have half a mind to make you read the chapter where she, Justine, goes to look at the apartment and Irene is there.
Eileen, Irene. But, I would be happy to read, if you want me to read that.
Like, no, I'm gonna tell our listeners that's my tantalizing clue.
Okay. That
everyone should read this book.
Lindsay was texting me as she was reading that chapter and she's like, "Are you there yet? Are you there yet?" I'm like, "I'm not there yet. Hold on, Jesus."
Some of my favorite books, I was getting to this before, are often very difficult to diffuse into two or three sentence plot descriptions.
Yes.
Because what they're doing is so beyond plot or narrative. It just feels like you're walking alongside these characters and suddenly there's a moment, like there was for me in the chapter that I just described, when it becomes so real that I realize the book's purpose is to live, to show what living is. Mm-hmm. And it's small moments that, you know, make up most of a life. And
yeah.
In its pureness of feeling, and its little weird perspective shifts, like when Justine is seeing herself and James from where they are and also from way out. I just love this book. I love how alive it is, even though it's partially about a dead man. There is just so much, and especially as a woman in my 40s, looking ahead and looking back, I just felt like it's the perfect book for me at this moment in my life. And I just want you to start from the beginning and tell me where this came to you. Like, what was the process like? How did you make this book?
Yeah. So Let's see. I started so there's a the character of Justine is probably the closest to me just in terms of, you know, age and life experience. But so there's three main women here. There's Justine, who's in her 40s. And she knew this guy James as a child, and then they had sort of like a one night stand. But then it got a little more than that, a little more complicated in their 20s. Then there's a character, Marina, who was James's girlfriend up until, you know, maybe a few weeks before he dies in this car accident. So they've broken up. And then his aunt Holly, who kind of was involved in raising him, and she's never been a mother, you know, by choice. Justine has a child, and Marina is kind of she's you know she's a bit younger, and I think she's wondering about what she wants her future to look like, in a number of ways. So I'm trying to think of where this book started, and something that is actually true to my life is that you know, there was someone that I had a brief encounter with when we were in our 20s. We lost touch in the way that people do, nothing dramatic. But then years later, I was here in Chicago, married with a kid, and I just saw, you know, rather abruptly, the way you do on Twitter, that he had died, and it came up in my feed, and we weren't even connected, but you know that you just sort of see stuff, and it just kind of stopped me in my tracks, and I didn't even really know how it made me feel. And I was like, is this grief? Am I entitled to grieve? Why am I even asking if I'm entitled to grieve? And so all these this sort of cascade of emotions, just sort of dealing with that and wanting to explore that, I felt like that seemed to me to be a good place to start a book. And so it kind of started with that character, and then I didn't only want it to be from her perspective. I wanted to get, you know, some of these from. I wanted to hear from, you know, characters who were differently involved with the same person, but I also wanted to explore these relationships. You know, for each of these women, their relationship with him was not necessarily a primary relationship. I think we maybe, I mean, grief is obviously a hugely complex thing, but I think we understand the contours of it, or we think we understand the contours of it when we're talking about someone, when you've lost someone really close to you. But I was interested in looking at those. What happens when you lose someone who maybe isn't, you know, actively part of your life, or it, you know, is not in your life in that way, but it still is really affecting, and affects your life, and affects how you go about just, you know, living your life.
Yeah, because it's like that person exists, that you exists until something like that happens. And then you kind of get unmoored and you kind of have to re-moor yourself, you know? And that's a process.
Starting with Justine, Deb, and then kind of going from there and thinking about other characters, you know, the characters that end up being Marina and Holly, characters that are differently involved. Did that always mean to you women of different ages than Justine? Did you always kind of have that in mind, or had that been an approach to a novel, women from different generations kind of dealing with not the same exact thing, obviously, because of their own personal lens, but dealing with, I'm trying to explain, just did the different generations aspect, different ages, all women have, was that an approach that you had been wanting to explore for a while in your fiction?
And that was they were always those characters were always their ages, more or less. I was interested in just looking at those different times of life. It was something that I had explored in my previous book. There was a character, who's I think 39, and another character who's 22, 23, and it's about their it's really about their interactions. And I think there's something about Justine's age, she's sort of in the middle, that allows her to kind of reflect back to Marina, but also ahead to Holly. And I think they all kind of serve as models or reference points for each other, either when they're thinking about their pasts or their presents or their futures.
I want to hear why, because this book is self-published.
Yes.
So I want to hear about your journey to that decision.
It's a long journey.
Because Alex and I also like can very much relate to what I think you're about to say. So
Absolutely. We
we
want to
want
hear
it.
it.
So this is my third book. My first book was published by William Morrow. Big Five. My second book was published by Catapult, so large independent press. And I will just, start by saying, like, publishing, my publishing journey has never been particularly smooth. It's always been kind of fraught. I don't exactly know why.
Fraught in what way?
Just like it never, I guess I thought maybe after, I published my first book, I thought maybe like getting the second one published would be a little bit easier. And it wasn't, I think, just in terms of, I guess the usual things you hear of, like, an editor wanting to buy your book and then not being able to for whatever reason, but you never really know the reason because it's all kind of opaque, and that sort of thing. So kind of feeling like I don't know. I don't know. But so we had to go out on submission with this one. I guess I've been hearing it's a weird time. Certainly, post during the pandemic, and I don't know if we are post-pandemic, but it just the responses that it was getting, the responses to the book when there were responses, were that, it wasn't my quote unquote breakout book. And I mean, I think I know what that means, but I'm not sure I'm ever gonna write a book that's considered a breakout book. And then it was also getting, this is too quiet, which is another thing that it's like, I don't know if that's code for something. If it is, maybe code for, like, it's not going to sell a lot of copies. But I kind of like it is quiet. It's a quiet book, and I like that about it. I feel like it asks the reader for a certain amount of attention, and hopefully it'll find readers who are willing to give it that attention. But so. It was out on submission for a long time, and I just started feeling like I was tired of waiting.
Waiting on the gatekeepers.
Waiting on the gatekeepers. And
it's so much waiting.
It's so much waiting, and
it's really,
waiting is
yeah.
so, it's
Ugh.
Excruciating, right? It's so
Yeah.
hard. And I guess I started feeling like, well, okay, if this isn't marketable for whatever reason at this moment, why can't I make it, you know, the art project that I want it to be? I just want to have this book out in the world. I want it to be an object that people can hold and read. And that was the goal. So I was talking to, I don't know, do you guys know Kathleen Rooney?
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
Rose Metal.
Yeah. So she's a terrific writer, and she also runs Rose Metal Press, an independent press. And I was talking to her kind of about, you know, is this doable? Like, if I want to put it out myself, but I want to put it out, you know, in a good, non-crappy way, you know, can I do that? And I talked to my agent about it too. And, you know, it began to seem like, something that was doable.
What was your agent saying?
So she was like, you know, ordinarily I would not advise this to my clients, but I think she felt like for this book and for me in particular, just I think she thought that I would be able to do a decent job with it. And that maybe I was in a place where I did have, you know, I this isn't my first book. I do have some sense of, like, you know, community and readership, and hopefully, and that I wasn't just coming out of nowhere. So I think maybe that had something to do with it. Yeah. And then, you know, the other thing is I feel like we're increasingly seeing this, you know, particularly in like the music industry or the movie industry, and these kind of legacy industries no longer are quite working in the way that they used to. And, you know, people are kind of coming up with different models. And a lot of some of the work that I do as a freelance writer, is for this design website. And I wind up talking to a lot of artists and designers, who were just, you know, putting the stuff that they make up on their websites and selling it. And I was like, why can't I do that with a book?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm trying. I'm going to see how it goes. It's a bit of an experiment. It's really energizing. Like, even the, you know, I've been enjoying the whole process, like the, you know, the post kind of editorial process, the actually making it into a book and sort of figuring out how to get it out in the world in a thoughtful way that can hopefully, you know, that will still reach people. Obviously, I don't have the resources of a, you know, of a traditional publishing house.
How do you get the book edited when you're like, who are you turning to edit it, to work with?
Yeah. So I, you know, it went through, a few revisions with my agent. And I really, you know, trust her sensibility, her edits. And, you know, I also have a few writer friends who are just amazing editors, and they looked at it as well. And then, so the work that I do, I kind of came up through, magazine editorial work. I still do that on a freelance basis. And so I, you know, I know copy editors. I know those people, and I was able to, you know, hire a woman that I'm friendly with to do that. And then it was also talking to friends. Kathleen, who I mentioned before, mentioned Bookmobile, which is this printer In Minneapolis, and they've done books for Grey Wolf, they've done books for Coffee House, but they also work with individuals, and they do a really beautiful, really professional job. So I was able to work with them to just kind of turn it into an actual book, and get it typeset, and yeah, watch it. Transform into a book.
Your cover is so striking. I was talking to Alex about this because it's like right now the trend in book covers is like Alex was calling them like the blobs of color and like florals or like faces, and like yours is just like this stark eggshell white with these three intersecting lines that continue on, and then
The
the
inner
inside,
flaps, yeah, so beautiful.
Alex
Oh,
was
thank
pointing that out.
you.
Yeah, I love that. I that was the important to me, the inside. Because I love the New York Review of Books classics. They all like all the inside, the interior covers are just kind of a contrasting color to the cover. So yeah, covers are I don't know. I remember my first book. I'm trying to think of like how honest I
Please
should.
be honest.
So with my first book, with the hard cover, there was this, so the first book I wrote, the first novel I published, centered on these two friends. So it was, sort of, if you wanted to distill it, it was a novel of female friendship. So young women, and I, was just kind of dreading the cover. But there was this William Eggleston photo that I loved and I had as a postcard, and it's a picture of these two young women. They're at a party, they're on a couch. One of the women
Oh
was
yeah,
his cousin. Yeah.
I think I
And
know
so
this picture.
yeah, it's a famous shot. And so I had sort of had that in mind, and I sent it to my editor at the time, and she loved it, and she was like, oh, but I don't think we can use it. And eventually, I got the images of the cover, and they were just, like stock photography of like two white women on a beach and
Oh my
just
God.
or in a field. And I just felt like that is not my book. And that's I don't know. And and it is, especially as a first time, is my first time doing all of this, I didn't know how much I could push back. And eventually, we wound up having some conversations, and ultimately, we got to use the Eggleston photo on the hardcover, which was amazing.
Oh, awesome.
And but it was hard. It was nerve-wracking, the whole process. And so for this one, I wanted to do something simple. I also, just for cost, I didn't want to get into having to license an image, or license someone's artwork. And I was looking at a lot of art books, which are obviously different. I mean, they're incredibly, they're visually heavy, but the covers are often so striking and plain, and they're just a color and type, and the title and the art author or artist's name. And so I just thought, yeah, may and maybe a simple cover actually winds up distinguishing it a little bit from the color blob cover.
Yeah, it really does. It really
That
does.
was
And
Lindsay's exact comment. Yeah.
like when I finished reading the book and I looked at the cover again, I was like, oh my God, the lines. I
Yeah,
get it.
the lines. Three intersecting
And
lines.
they keep
Yeah. And they
going.
keep going.
It is so like a book that you stop and go like, what is that?
You're
That's
right. And you're
so good to
really right
hear.
about art books too. Like I'm thinking like any of those like big Steidl like monographs, they're like so often, you're right, just like the name of the artist and the name of the book itself and onto the work. Like it's not flashy. That's so true. I hadn't thought about that.
And I know, I mean, I my understanding is that, the color blob covers look the way they do because they work well as, thumbnails and
Yeah, because
everything.
we're all ostriches. We're all like, ooh, shiny.
Right,
It's such a lame explanation because it's like, all right, that may objectively be true that I can see the little blue dots and red dots better on my phone, but to what end? Like, what are we actually saying? Like I can watch a football game better on a TV than on my phone. That doesn't, okay, what are we talking about? I don't even know what you're saying. Like these are just facts. Like what's going on Go
here?
Broncos.
That's right. God. Anyway, sorry.
I would like to bring up a spoilery thing. Not that
Okay,
this
go ahead.
book is a book that can be spoiled. Like the guy is dead.
You know
But
that from the outset.
I thought it was so like badass of you that in the final pages the pandemic happens. And I wanted you to tell us about that choice.
Well, so I started writing it before the pandemic. And then, obviously the pandemic happened. And I was writing it, during the pandemic. Especially like that first year. And so it was always set in the present ish, right? And I think it became, I didn't want it to take place during the pandemic because they're not living that kind of life. They're living pre-pandemic existence. But I also, wanted it to be it's set in, our it's a realistic novel. I think I do feel like it is a novel of moments, of connected moments, and moving through these women's lives. And so I wasn't exactly sure. I knew where I wanted to end it, but I wasn't exactly sure, how to get maybe like the penultimate material before the ending. And it just kind of made sense to kind of put them right at the beginning of everything when we didn't really know where things were going. And just trying to deal with that really big unknown and kind of, what that brings out in them and what changes and what doesn't. And, the fact that, like, again, not to be spoilery, but, Alex, the famous photographer, like, flees to
I
his
was gonna
country.
say, fuck
And
that guy.
Holly is like, stuck in her condo with her cat. So, yeah.
But she has power over him in that moment, which is so interesting.
Totally, totally. Yeah, that was really interesting to me to explore that relationship. I there's there there is that certain kind of, I don't want to say Holly's a type, but there's a certain kind of woman that I'm always sort of drawn to. These women who, and Holly describes them as like a loose network of women who were sort of part of some scene, that maybe like a few kind of well-known
My God, I
figures
forgot
emerged
about that part. That
from.
part is so great.
Oh, thanks. And so, and so these few often male figures emerge, and then, like I am the kind of person that I will like go online and like go down rabbit holes and read about these, some like scene in New York from the like early 80s, and that, some filmmaker or, interesting art came out of. And they, you all I will always read about these women who are now, school teachers or nurses or, real estate agents, and they live upstate or they live, in New Jersey. And And I'm always like, I want to know about them. I want to know what happened to them.
Yeah,
And
I have to read it because you said she was thinking of the women who had booked acts at dank clubs whose dankness would later be written about in legendary terms, who had played bass in no wave bands, who painted, who shot video, who took photographs, who danced. They had moved out of the city when they could no longer afford it, had become registered nurses, school teachers, half-hearted real estate agents, social workers. Some had had children, others never did. She had never thought of those women as a different kind of loose network, though that's what they were. The women whose work was not in a museum or preserved on a record or printed in a book and never would be because their early efforts had been lost to obscurity or had been ephemeral to begin with. The women who would become footnotes in the more celebrated lives of others. God, it's so true.
And that's really one of the main things I wanted to explore in this book. I feel like each of these characters feels like a footnote in, or they're made to feel like a footnote in James's life, in the life of this more celebrated character. And yeah, so I think I wanted to look at to just get a closer look at their lives, but also like, yeah, what, like, I don't know. I mean, people are characterized as footnotes in other people's lives, but do those people actually feel that way about their own lives? I don't think so, right? Yeah.
Life is long. That's the other
Right.
thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's very, very long,
It
truthfully. I guess not for James. Wah, wah, wah.
No.
God, that was, I'm so sorry. I've been ill and it's just all coming out now.
No.
I really want to talk about New York because it feels like I said this to I think to Lynn Stigerstrong on Twitter that this feels like a love letter to New York. I know
Oh.
that's such a thrown around cliched phrase, but it really does feel like of a place. And
Yeah.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
For sure. Yeah, I didn't set out to do that, or it wasn't my intention. I think to write a love letter to New York, but I think it definitely is that. And I think part of it is because I did want to explore this time in in, or it started with the Justine character and this time in her life that was really formative for her. And for me, that time was in, I spent it in New York, in my, my 20s and 30s. And then I moved to Chicago. This one has about 37. So there were these really, formative, it was a formative place. And that's where a lot of my memories are. And I think memory and sort of the accumulation and the accretion of memory is really important to me as a writer, and how characters look back on their lives and how those, how their pasts influence and continue to influence their presence. And how they might move forward. And so for me, the place where I still go is New York, and also Boston, because that's, where I grew up.
Did
So
you have a
yeah.
mushroom growing in your bathroom in New York?
I
Like
did.
Justine?
I
You did?
did. I
Oh God. In New York is so gross.
Yeah, and I didn't, I mean, I didn't mind it at
Right.
the
I love how Justine is just like, this is where I'm supposed to be, and this is
Right.
exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And I think maybe you reach a point in your life where you're like, okay, maybe it's not cool to have a mushroom like growing through
That
the
weird?
grout
I
in my
know.
bathroom. Like maybe that's not okay. And I shouldn't be living like this. And so I think, I was thinking about this because when people write these love letters to New York, or there's sort of like the cottage industry of like the I'm leaving New York essay, right? Or this is why I'm leaving New York. And I feel like it's to there's a lot of reasons to miss New York, but I feel like I think, or I wonder if a lot of that has to do with people missing their youth. Because, you know, people often wind up leaving when, you know, at a certain age, when it's like, you know, it doesn't, that life that you've been living no longer feels like it's quite, working for you. Yeah.
It's tiring.
It's tiring.
I'm too tired. Yeah. My two good friends who lived in New York, they both moved to LA at, you know, around the exact same time.
Yeah. And how are they?
They're still there. They love it.
Yeah.
Sunshine. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. LA seems great. Yeah. So I don't know what it is. I think it's for me, it's having spent your youth in a place. And I wonder if I had spent my youth in a different city, if I would, you know, be writing about that city. I don't know.
Did you have particular photographers in mind, either as models for Alex or James?
No one, you know, no one specific. You know, for James, I wound up looking at a lot of, you know, just documentary photography or books of war photography. I actually wound up reading, there's a memoir by Lindsay Addario, she's a photographer. I think she's primarily with the New York Times, and she wrote a memoir. And Marina, the character of Marina, kind of reflects on this a little bit. It was so interesting for me to read her memoir, because she's a woman in this, you know, field that is kind of dominated by men. And I just thought her, you know, I would read interviews with the male photographers, and I would read interviews with her, and she, I just felt it was so much easier to relate to her and her outlook and kind of what she was trying to do. So there was that. And then I feel like, you know, all the kind of big photographers of the 70s and 80s, I think probably shade into Alex's work. You know,
Stephen Shore.
Yeah.
I named one person as if that's a list.
I know. I'm blanking on all
Stephen
these.
Shore, William Eggleston, who you've already named.
Lee Friedlander. Yeah.
Sure.
We can get to
five, I bet, but it's right. <Yeah. just
laughs> not meant to be about them. I don't
of
know
course.
What
of
their
course.
Lives are like, but in terms of the work that he kind of does,
absolutely. That was what I thought would be so fun about writing about a photographer, is even if none of the biography leaked into the narrative in any way, it would just be fun to imagine what the work looked like, to imagine what the photographs were. I feel like that would be such a fun project.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I think they are kind of Stephen Shore-esque.
Sure.
In my mind. Yeah.
What are you planning on doing for like a little book tour or marketing?
Yeah. So I'm going to be doing a reading at Exile in Bookville, and I'm going to be doing another event at Seminary Co-op. So both in Chicago, and you know, I'm trying to figure out if I should try to, you know, organize something else. It's hard because, you know, it's all on my dime now.
Yeah.
And, you know, will it make sense financially? I'm trying to figure out what I can do and do it in a way that feels, you know, not gross to me.
What about little Zoom events?
I would love to do that. I think I just need to figure out how to coordinate that. So this is all I'm kind of learning as I go, and trying to figure out how to, you know, how to best get this out in the world. And the thing, I know we had talked about this a little bit earlier, is this idea I think gets kind of or it got drilled into me anyway, like in publishing, of that, you know, your book basically has a lifespan of like the week that it published, right? And then that's it. And that's why pre-orders matter so much, because they go into those first week sales. And then like after that, it's like, okay, on to the next thing, right? And then maybe when your paperback comes out, you get a chance to, you know, kind of try and get a little bit of attention again. And, you know, I understand why it works that way, or, you know, I don't understand it necessarily, but I can grasp, you know, the concept. But I feel like that's not how I read books. I don't, you know, it's not like a book comes out and I have to read it right away, or it's, you know, or it's spoiled. If anything, I think that books, for me, they, you know, they're lasting, or good books are lasting. So I to the extent that I can, I'm trying to move away from that model. And hopefully, you know, the thing is, like, I'm sort of like the one woman show with this. Like, I'm the publisher, I'm the distributor. So like all the books are here.
And the
So I can,
publicist,
as long as, yeah, and the publicist, so as long as I can store them, I can sell them. So hopefully I can figure out a way to keep some kind of momentum going, or hopefully, like, as people read it, maybe, you know, they will tell a friend about it, and
That
you know,
really
word of
matters.
mouth.
I really think that matters, you know, as much as pre-orders. And you're exactly right. Like, I don't read really any book the week it comes out, and I probably don't have it then either, you know. Like, I get it when I can get to it, you know. I have like my little like going to read, want to read list, you know. And it's unfair, because often I discover books, you know, months or a year or 2 years after they came out, and I'm like, this was really great, I want to talk about it,
Totally.
you know. It's
And
just
the other thing is, there's so few books that actually enter into any kind of cultural conversation.
Oh my God.
So for the most part, it's like a conversation you're having yourself with the book, right? Which is great. Like that's what I want as a reader usually. So I kind of feel like you don't, you know, and the listicles that are like 80 books to read in, you know, the next week. You know?
It's
It's
that is barely an exaggeration.
It is exactly. It's like the most anticipated books of the fall, and it's like 300 titles. And it's like, I can't do it. I'll try, but I can't.
I mean, we read, you know, cl we don't record every week, but pretty much every week we
Yeah,
record.
you must read
And
a lot. Yeah.
so we read, you know, a book a week. And honestly, it's difficult to read a book a week. And
Yeah.
that's like breakneck speed.
Yes, totally.
I mean,
Right.
so some of these lists, it's like, yeah, it's bizarre. And you know, it's like the people are pe publicists pay to get these books on most of these lists, or you know, and not that I believe that's nefarious or anything at all. It's just that's how the business works. And it's so, I think there's so many small things like that where it's not even really hidden, a lot of that stuff. It's just like you said earlier, Deb, you know, there are aspects of publishing that are very opaic, and are it's hard to it's hard it feels difficult to access the ultimate opinion that matters when there's a close no, or you know, an almost. It feels impossible to understand if the almost was actually a, oh hell no, you never were close. And yet on the back end, for me at least, it always feels that way. It's like, you know what, I was deluding myself thinking that I had a chance here. This is And yet, what's so interesting to me, listening to you describe this process with your book right now, with Consolation, is it reminds me so much of my first two books, which were published on very, very small presses, neither of which had distribution. And so to get them in bookstores, I would just go to the bookstores and say, hey, would you guys carry the book? And
And bookstores
And
have been really supportive, I have
I
to
was gonna
say.
say, I mean, so many, and I don't know if this is a Chicago thing or not, but I mean, so many bookstores said yes, and they were like, absolutely,
Amazing.
we will sell it on consignment, no problem. Here's the form, we'll be in touch. And it's like, ultimately, that like you were saying, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for people to have access to your book, which they absolutely do in bookstores here in Chicago, and I'm sure elsewhere, but also online, the same way they would buy any other goddamn book. So I mean, it's like there's so much of this that it's like, you went through every single other step of this process, and yet still we have the book, which is fantastic. So I'm so happy to kind of hear more of the details of this, because really it's like, really what you did is you started a small press and it's printed and here it is.
B-side editions.
There you go. Hell yeah.
But and I wanted to it made me think, when you were talking about you never know, was the almost actually a hell no. And
Right, right.
I think earlier in my, I don't want to say my writing career, but I don't know what else to call it. I think I would have taken this rejection really hard. And I would have thought, I'm a terrible writer. Like clearly, like my work it's lacking something, right? And I think I've gotten to a point where I have enough belief in what I do and the kind of writing that I want to do that I didn't feel that way this time. I felt like, no, it's not, it's something about, it's not me, it's them. Yes. But like that it's the publishing, and for whatever reason, it's not marketable, but maybe it can be marketable enough for me, for what I
Absolutely.
want to do.
It is such a fantastic book. I have been thinking about it ever since I finished reading it.
You.
I can't say enough about it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
You. That is really wonderful to hear.
There's something for everyone.
Can I use
Yeah.
that
Yes, that's free of charge. Lindsay Hunter on Theraflu. There's something for everyone.
Yeah, how much did you take?
I drank my little cup of hot Theraflu, the
Get the
normal
dosage on the blurb just to be
amount.
sure.
Yeah, how much did you take?
Yeah.
Normal amount, I think.
God. Exactly.
The book is Consolation. The writer is Deborah Shapiro. It is so great. If they want to get a copy, do they go to bsideeditions.com? How do they do it?
They go to my website, which is
Got it.
Deborah-Shapiro.com. And you can find it there. I think if you Google it, you can probably it hopefully comes up pretty quickly. And it'll also be available at select bookstores.
Do you want to shout a few out in the Chicago area that have it?
Exile in Bookville is gonna have it.
Awesome.
They're
Love Javier. Love
amazing. I mean, all
Kristen.
the bookstores around here are great. And Seminary Co-op, Pilsen Community Books,
Awesome.
Volumes Books, and I need to make the rounds and
All the great indies here. That's awesome.
Volumes just reopened.
He That's
just very
right.
exciting.
God, that's so wild.
Awesome. So call any of those bookstores and order several copies and start a book club and
I'm
invite Deborah to come via Zoom.
happy to zoom in.
There you go.
Thank you so much for coming on. This was
Thank
awesome.
you. This was great. Thank you so much for having me.
Good
Yes,
luck with
appreciate it.
this, and
Thank
it's going to be
you.
great.
Thank you
Awesome.
guys so much.
Yeah, thank you, Deb.
Bye.
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 Alex, what did you put in the chat?
Oh, the picture she was talking about.
Oh,
Did it not
okay.
come up? I don't know.
No,
I
I
don't know how to
clicked to
do
download
shit.
it and it was like potential security issue detected.
Oh, weird. No,
So I didn't.
it was just that picture that she was describing.
The girls on the couch.
Yeah.
Okay.
I put a virus in the chat.
Let's end this.
Lindsay, I just gave our computers cancer, so we're fucked.
I haven't even paid off this Mac yet. How God. Could you?
Oh my God. I'm so glad we had Deb on. That was really cool and a unique story for us on the show, even though I think a lot of writers have gone through similar beats, and especially over the past couple of years. And I think Deb made such a cool decision with the book, and it turned out beautiful.
God, it's so beautiful. It's so like meticulous.
Mm-hmm.
I love that she called it an art object, because it does feel mm-hmm. that way. I loved it. I loved it more than I thought I was going to love it. Because I'm familiar with Deb's work and
right.
knew like I was in good hands. And then I just was swept away. So highly recommend. It's paperback, so you know, you don't have to like strain your back carrying it around.
Is that a concern for people?
You know, Ben actually, like, he gets all excited when he's reading a book on his e-reader, because he's like, oh, you know, he's like, I don't gotta carry the book on the train.
Oh my God,
it's all on the Kindle. So yes, people do worry about that.
Hey, we Ben, were person.
We were watching a lot of football today.
Good.
And
what did you watch that goddamn Ravens game?
Yes. Oh well, we have God. The red zone. We have the red zone. So we watched all the games.
So jealous.
It was amazing. It was like the first Sunday I actually got to like sit and watch. What is your favorite footballism?
Like saying?
Yes.
Oh my God. That's such a great question. Can you mine, give me yours? Yeah.
Mine is keep the drive alive. KTDA.
I don't know. Maybe like ground and pound.
I don't think I've even heard of that one.
Oh, you know what? They got to get back to ground and pound, running the ball.
Oh my goodness. I like when like the big offensive guy or the big defensive guy accidentally gets the ball and starts running for the end zone.
Oh yeah. Fat guy touchdown.
He's
love
rumbling
it.
And rumbling and jumbling.
Rumbling, jumbling, bumbling.
Yeah. I was getting reacquainted with all my footballisms.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It's truly delightful.
I love football. I feel the same way. It's funny, like people I'm being apologetic about right now, but I really don't have I'm not conflicted about this. I just love football.
You know, I went through a long phase of like being very conflicted about it, because mm-hmm. I love it. And I started mm-hmm. watching it when like Ben was in law school and he'd have to study all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just like put the TV on and it would be football, and I would like want him to like hear it so he could feel like he was, you know. And
yeah.
I was just like getting really into it.
Of course.
Like I love learning about the players, and I love like I don't know.
It's, are you a Dolphins fan?
I'm not.
You're not. You will just. I mean, with red zone, that's like that's another level of you.
Yeah.
Truly, you don't have to be wed to a team to enjoy right. red zone. Oh my God.
Yeah, I never really had like a pro team, like a Florida pro team that I mm-hmm. loved. I went to FSU because I loved the Seminoles mm-hmm. when I was a kid, and I don't remember why. So I went to FSU for 1 year.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in their theater program.
Wow.
And it was just like too much of a change. I wanted to be closer to my family.
I mean, that's a massive school, right?
It's a pretty big school, but it feels, it's like Tallahassee.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Tallahassee and like the Panhandle, they feel like the South, whereas Orlando doesn't feel like anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I transferred back to UCF in Orlando mm-hmm. after my first year, and it was a better fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
Go Knights. But pro football, I don't really have. I just want everyone to have a good time, you know? I love Scott Hansen on the red zone.
Oh, my God. He's amazing.
He has the dream job.
Yeah, football.
Football. Love it. Oh, you're ready for some football.
And it's just so fun for gambling because it's all one day. I mean, except for Thursday and Monday, so you can really get nuts.
I haven't done that side of it, but I trust that you're right.
Yeah.
And my whole family's sick.
Same.
There's like stomach bug, maybe pink eye. God. What do you guys have?
You know what? It's a lot of like runny nose, cough, mm-hmm. drainage, no sleep,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. I got something though. Do you have a strong feeling about the movie Hocus Pocus?
I have never seen it.
I just watched it with the girls. I think I've seen it, I don't know, five times, easily five times. I think it's great. That's my only opinion. I love it. Love Bette
Okay.
Midler.
I've heard good
Love
things.
Sarah Jessica
Are you excited
Parker.
about the new one?
Sure, I will watch it. I'm gonna watch
Okay.
it. Absolutely.
All right.
That's all I got.
All right. I'll make sure I watch that with
I think you'd like it. It's like lots
certain
of like
children.
faces and like, goofing around.
I like that. I think I was too old for it when it came out,
Okay.
because I feel like it was a big part of a lot of my friends' childhoods, younger
Okay.
friends.
I think
But
it's
like
like
I,
93.
yeah, I don't, you're probably, I don't know. I was obsessed with this
Yeah, 93.
movie called The Worst Witch, which was a
I
young
don't even
Firouza
know
Balk.
it. Oh, of course.
And
She's a legend.
yes, lots of famous Broadway or Shakespearean actors and actresses. Tim Curry plays the Grand Wizard.
The Grand Wizard.
Yes, it is
Oh my God.
terrible effects, but I don't know. It just slapped. We just loved it. We had it, me and my sister had it memorized and still do.
God.
You should Google the Grand Wizard's Anything Can Happen on Halloween song because it is
Oh
bizarre.
my God, there's a lot of things called The Worst Witch because I was looking at the wrong thing
There's a,
first.
yeah, they did a remake for Netflix, like a show,
Okay.
which I think is actually kind of good. I think we've watched like one or two episodes, but
Oh my God, Tim
nothing like the
Curry.
original.
Like you said, Tim Curry, but it didn't register to me what the fuck you were saying.
Yeah.
Holy
The
shit.
Tim Curry.
The Tim Curry. I
Yes.
just always think of that line from Home Alone 2 with him.
I don't remember.
Your very own cheese pizza. I can't do a Tim Curry voice at all.
Come here to me, come here to me.
Oh, exactly. Jesus.
That's
He's
it.
April. He's April like us.
Oh, really? That makes
Yeah.
so much sense.
Yeah, because he's so handsome
Yes, and talented.
and talented and great.
I'm reading a great book called Diary of a Misfit, and I know this book doesn't need any recommendations because I think everyone's loving it, but it's a memoir about a journalist who is researching a transgender man.
Whoa, great cover.
Who was named Roy and was kidnapped as a child and as a girl child and then dressed and treated like a boy
Whoa.
because that child's parents allegedly abused him. Anyway, but it's
Jesus, I
about
don't.
like it's about the journalist's life and childhood and relationship with her mother, and it's about like trying to figure out this mystery of Roy and like getting, and I don't know, I love it. It's so good.
Yeah, it sounds
That and
fucking
Consolation.
done. Consolation, yes.
Killing me.
Awesome. All right. Have
Have a life.
the best week of your life.
Oh God, I okay, thank you.
Hope you live. Hope you stay alive. All
You
right.
too.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
Yeah!